Hello everyone, welcome to another oneliner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig. With me, as always, Scott.
Hey, how you doing?
And as reliable as ever, Drew.
Hello.
Apologies for the delay, just as we were getting into the swing of our brand new schedule. Scott
died.
Somewhat selfishly died, yes. And it's all right, he
got
has
better.
Been replaced. Yeah, he got better. We replaced him with a genetically engineered clone. Very advanced, very advanced. Don't ask too many questions, just accept it. So we've got quite a list to get through on this occasion, so without further ado, let us crack on. Unless your head has been trapped in amber for the last 17 million years, you probably have noticed that there is a new James Bond film in your local cinema, going by the moniker of Skyfall. Scott, what about Skyfall?
What about Skyfall?
It is a film.
That's true. We've established that.
Yes.
It's a James Bond film, I think.
It's got James Bond in it and that. It's the 50th anniversary Bond film, which has presented, some would say opportunities, I would say slight annoyances, but I don't know.
Skyfall continues a path, I suppose, that was resurrected with Casino Royale. It belongs to the school of somewhat more grounded in realism Bonds that haven't seen a lot of since, you know, Dr. No and From Russia with Love. Well, it centres around a plot by a initially unknown individual to steal a list of all MI5 or MI6 operatives in the field, and it seems that this is being used as leverage to get to M, the leader of MI6, played, of course, by Judi Dench. Now, as part of the gimmick of the film, I suppose, it starts off with James Bond getting shot and presumably killed, although you can't keep a good man down, so he very quickly comes back to service.
Much like you did, Scott.
Yes, he got better, although how much better is perhaps the hinge of the film. It is putting a lot of stock in seeing whether Bond's basically still got what it takes after his near-death experience. I don't think I'm spoiling too much to say that the big bad turns out to be Javier Bardem, seen as in the trailer and all that stuff. He is pursuing a vendetta against M and is doing what it takes to even a score. I did like Skyfall an awful lot. I think it's one of the better Bond films. I don't think it's better than Casino Royale, which is, seen as, I'll just put that up front, seeing as a lot of people have been saying, oh, this is actually, you know, film of the year candidates. I don't think it is, but I did like it a lot.
It's nowhere near a film of the year candidate. I myself made the mistake of coming out of the cinema and pretty much immediately going, yes, that's the best Bond film ever. And on second thought, I'd probably like to go and see it again, because the more I thought about it, the more I thought, actually, Casino Royale probably is better.
Mm-hmm. As I kind of alluded to earlier, to me, there's always seems to be two strains of Bond film. There's the Bond film that everyone kind of knows and is put up with, you know, big silly gadgets, over-the-top plots, all that kind of stuff. And there's a few in the, what are we up to? 23.
Yeah.
There's maybe, what, six or seven that are a little bit more realistic. The first two, you know, maybe Thunderball and Goldfinger, those two. And then
and the two Timothy Dalton ones.
Yeah, the two Dalton ones, you know, maybe From Russia with Love and the new fellas, the Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace to an extent, and Skyfall. And those films, and I suppose On Her Majesty's Secret Service as well.
Because the massive hypnotic plot to take over the world wasn't silly.
Yeah,
I was going to say, Her Majesty's Secret Service is a fucking fever dream.
But I suppose, I'm thinking more in terms of Bond's characterisation in that one,
which
is perhaps where I'm coming with the second part, is that those films are either some of my favourites or at least some of the ones that I found most interesting. I mean, On Her Majesty's Secret Service is interesting, it's shite, because George Lazenby's basically wood. But,
yeah, but on the upside, it doesn't have Roger Moore in it, so
that's
all
true.
Good.
But there is a lot to like in Skyfall. It is handled like it's a quote-unquote proper film rather than a Bond film. It's making proper attempts at characterization, drama and progression of these characters, and it works on that basis. It does, for the most part, make sense. Where it falls down is where I think more where it's trying to insert elements to make it fall more into the Bond film franchise. I mean, like, there's a point in, you know, three quarters of the way through where, for no particularly good reason, it is determined that the big bad guy, Silva, is it?
Mm-hmm.
He seems to have control of all of the London Underground for some reason, and can and can use a subway train as a weapon.
Can throw trains at people.
When it starts going over the top, it's actually much less interesting. I mean, the finale works better, and it's just, you know, Bond and his old gamekeeper, who I think should get his own franchise.
Yes.
It's a little bit schizophrenic in that respect. I mean, I think it still works. I still enjoyed it the most part. There are flaws in it. I didn't really buy Silva's, not so much his motivation, but his methods. It seems like initially it's focused on, you know, trying to tear down M's, you know, professional edifice and his, you know, ruin her career, that kind of thing. Then all of a sudden she just goes, well, had enough of that, let's just go and shoot her. Which, if you were going to do that, you could have made things a lot easier just by simply doing that in the first place. His methods seem a bit arbitrarily linked to a plot progression rather than anything that makes sense for his character. It's not really a major flaw. It can survive that, partly because Javier Bardem's so effective in the role, but it doesn't really work, I think, in terms of motivation for that character. That aside, there's just an awful lot to like. Craig's performance as Bond, is the kind of slight hints of self-doubt that pops back in there. And
thanks very much. Craig's performance as Bond, I said thanks very much.
Oh, yeah, good. Ralph Fiennes looks like he's a good addition to the franchise. Almost everything about it works quite well. It's very well handled for the most part by Mendes, and it's, you know, looks probably more professionally done than most Bond films. It does look like it's had some cinematographic thought put into it.
Mm.
Yeah, overall, I did like it an awful lot. It's not going to make my films of the year list, and it's not going to make my top Bond film lists, but it's in the running, I suppose, and can't ask for much more than that.
In retrospect, and I'll need to see it again, I suspect it's probably going to, for my money, be either second or third best Bond film behind Casino Royale, and either ahead of or just behind, probably, From Russia With Love. But the more I thought about it, I mean, initially I was riding on this wave of just, yahoo, it's a new Bond film, because that's...
Yeah. That's your bag.
That's my bag, yeah. Like, okay, James Bond, cinema screen, thanks very much. It's got my single favourite moment, probably, or one of my single favourite moments from a Bond film ever, which is in the trailer anyway, so it's not like I'd see it, but just to see it on a big screen anyway, and just have everyone in the cinema just appreciate it anyway, was fantastic. Obviously, going to see a screening in a Scottish cinema, there was a great appreciation of several lines in the last sort of third of the film. There's some nice Scottish-related dialogue in there. Some nice Scottish sentiment as well from your gamekeeper fellow. What's his name again?
I think it's Groundskeeper Willie.
Groundskeeper Willie, yes, as portrayed
Albert Finney's,
by
Kincaid.
Albert Finney. That's it, Kincaid. That sort of gave the audience, a Scottish audience, a good sort of, even though he's English. You know, his English, and sort of barely attempting a Scottish accent, he almost got away with it. The more I think about it, the more of a bizarre beast it is. This decision that was made to bring Mendes on board and let's actually make this a credible film, not just a Bond film, but actually have it be a credible thriller in its own right, almost, was the intention from the outset that we were all led to believe. And then I'm not sure of the motivation. I've heard that it's only because it was the 50th anniversary Bond that you have these nods to the older Bond films, and like the DB5, which stuck out like a sore thumb. And there are some moments in there which were obviously intended to be little nice moments, like it's not to give anything away, there's a moment where Bond and M are in the DB5 and he sort of, she's giving him some snash and he flips up the top of the gear stick to reveal the red button. And like, they could have just left it at that and that would have been a nice joke for the Bond fans. But then Dench has to say, oh, what are you going to do? Eject me. You're like, well, yeah, we got that was the joke. If you didn't get that joke to begin with, they're not going to get it just because you've said that. That was an annoyance. That wasn't a point it was trying to make. I just had to get that out. They've made this strange decision. The whole point of the reboot with Casino Royale was to do away with the old elements of the old Bond films that made them ridiculous. I don't want Q Branch anymore. I don't want gadgets.
It seemed unnecessary, Q Branch.
Yeah, so I'm interested to see where they're going to go with this. It's like, why bother to reintroduce things like that? Now, I've heard some people saying that, or I've read in various places that, oh, you know, it's because it's the 50th anniversary Bond, that's like another... It's like, okay, in the timeline of Bond films, this comes sometime after the events of Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace. So, where do we go from here? Does the story then... Do we then head back in time for the next film? Or will the next film take place after this one? Because I don't see why they'd go to the trouble of setting up the sort of several new characters that they did. Well, not new characters, old characters. And I don't want to give anything away for the three people in the planet who haven't, like, seen it yet. But by the end of the film, you're sort of going, oh, right, okay. That's who this person's turned out to be. for at least two of the characters. And I don't necessarily want that.
I can kind of see the need to have someone doing Q's role. I was heartened somewhat
Q's role is just to go, we don't do gadgets anymore, what's the point in Q?
Well,
if his role is just to go, here's a gun for you, Bond. Have a man in a cage at MI6. I don't need Q.
Well, I think what they're aiming for is not so much that Q is going to be the gadget guy anymore, it's he's going to be the tech guy.
Hmm.
And I suspect you would. It's the role that some of the sort of almost no-name support characters had in the previous ones, though, you know, that where's Bond, you know, tracking him by satellite and that kind of thing, and he's going to be the one giving the answers to that. And
yeah, but someone, then, but
someone
then
has
he should,
to do that.
Should
it might
be,
as well be Q. Why not?
Well, yeah, but it shouldn't be Q Branch then. It should be IT Branch. Hi, Bond. I'm IT. Oh, hi, IT. It's not Q. That's just really annoyed me. And the other character who was introduced, although it's like, okay, if you're going to go down that line from now on, I suppose it's quite nice what you've done, but I don't want to go down that line. So I'm really sort of like, it's all going to hinge on where it goes from here now, man. It's all going to hinge on where it goes from here. Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it overall. I did really enjoy it as a Bond film. It kind of almost, in a lot of respects, in that sense, hit a sweet spot between new Bond and old school Bond. It's just that it feels like it could be the top of a slippery slope, and I don't want that to happen. I don't want us to take a giant step back.
Yeah, I don't know if you got... Well, I suppose time will tell. I mean, given how much of new Bond was in this and how little of old Bond was, I think we should be okay with that.
Yeah, I hope these little bits here and there were just, it's like, okay, it's the 50th anniversary thing, but then they in themselves didn't seem enough to justify that, if you know what I mean. They didn't seem enough of an addition to be a nod, just like, we're going to make this like chock full of all this stuff. Cramp, shoehorn this stuff in wherever you can, because there wasn't that much of it. So it could easily have done without it. Which annoyed me. I'm interested, but also incredibly scared to see where we go from here with the Bond films. I hope we do just revert back to all new Bond, but we'll see. We'll see. Obviously, one of those roles that I mentioned, again, not to go too far, but given the progression of the plot in the film, that character in the new role is essential. And I'm not talking about Q. But the rest of it, meh. We'll see. But I still really, really enjoyed it. I still loved it. Here's the other thing for you as well. Please, why did we have the dodgy... Right, see at the start, Scott, motorbike chase across the rooftops in... Marrakesh, but it wasn't. Where the hell was
Istanbul.
It? Istanbul. Right, we didn't need the close-up shots of Bond on the motorbike, which looked like terrible sort of 70s rear projection. The composite on it was so bad. It looked like a really dodgy, and we could have done without those. That totally ruined it and took me out of what was otherwise a fantastic chase sequence.
On the plus side, there wasn't a pigeon doing a double take at a hover gondola.
No, that's
we've come a long way.
Could so easily have happened. So yeah, it's. I view it with sort of a little bit more mixed feeling now. And anyone following the one-liner Twitter feed, that's my. I have to take on board the responsibility for that joyous tweet. Oh, that's the best Bond film ever! Well, it's probably not, actually. If I could take it back, I would. It's too late now. Yeah, so there you go. We'll see what happens. Cheers, Nimrod. Well, what would another year be without another Resident Evil movie?
Much better, yeah.
The re-word following the... colon this time is Retribution, Scott, am I correct? Resident Evil colon Retribution.
Yes, which seems disappointingly low-powered for the Resident Evil franchise. Haven't they already had an Armageddon? At this point, Retribution's a little bit lame.
Yeah.
As, indeed, is the film.
There was Armageddon and Extinction?
Armageddon, Extinction, Afterlife, and...
Who's after left that, surely it's like, Retribution?
Yeah, it's Resident Evil... universal entropy.
Yes, they're running out. They've set up another one for next year, which is brilliant. I do not propose to spend an awful lot of time talking about Resident Evil, because when any series gets to its fifth installment, it's pretty much critic proof. If the people who like this sort of thing are going to watch it regardless of what I say, it's not like I'm going to be able to save anyone from wandering into the franchise that hadn't already been exposed to it. I suppose it's a good thing, given that this is based on a video game franchise, that it's not paying any attention whatsoever to the video game franchise, because that's always a recipe for a dreadful film, although it's not really helped in this instance. again, we're following Mila Jovovich's Alice, who of course is in none of the games, and who by this point has been cloned about 100 times, became superpowered, got de-superpowered, which I suppose is probably still fairly mundane by Resident Evil game protagonist standards, so it's got that going for it. This film starts exactly where the last film ended. They had spent the whole film overcoming incredible odds to get to this one converted oil tanker, which was holding one of the last of humanity's colonies, and it kind of pans back to show an attack force coming towards it, which is where this picks up. Turns out that the computer from the first film, if you can remember back that far, the Umbrella computer AI, the Red Queen, has somehow magically become in control of everything, taking control from Albert Wesker, and has decided to kill everything by creating lots more of these horrible bio-mutant zombie things. During the initial attack, Alice is captured and wakes up in an Umbrella underground facility and is quickly rescued by Ada Wong, who's from Resident Evil 4, who's also still in league with Albert Wesker, and they're decided to join forces to take down the Red Queen. He's also sent a backup team who are attempting to attack from the other end of the laboratory. It's Leon S. Kennedy, with Luther West, who I think wasn't in the games, but was in one of the previous films. And finally, Barry Burton.
Yeah, that's almost reason. Does he stroke a magnum at any point?
He does have the ridiculous hand cannon. So they kind of fight across these, what, effectively holodecks, which are, there's some rationale for them to be simulating urban areas for, you know, to show off the effects of their weaponry divisions and that kind of stuff. But yeah, let's not bother about the technical details too much. It winds up with basically for an excuse to bring back pretty much every character that's been in the franchise so far, including like people who haven't been seen since the first film, like Colin Salmon's, I think the guy was just called One in that film, and Michelle Rodriguez's Rain Ocampo, and Jill Valentine's back, and everyone else is back as well. Why not? It just throws absolutely everything from the previous films into a big pot, stirs it a bit, heats up a little bit in a microwave and throws it back out onto the screen. It's basically a downloadable content film. There's not really anything new in here. It's the same stupid CG action that's still, you know, just as stupid and ugly as it was in all the previous films. But by this point, I don't think that's going to stop anyone.
Has it got bacon dogs in it?
No bacon dogs, sadly, no. Just rubbish 3D. I suppose the 3D is actually less offensive here because it's not trying to be anything other than a big stupid gimmick, so there's that. For all I'm saying, it does throw so many things in there that it can't help but at least be almost passably interesting at a few points, probably by accident. It's, I would say, the least intolerable of the series yet, but that's not much of a reason to go and see it. No,
be honest, is that just because Barry Burton's in it?
Yeah. With the same... Is it an orange or red ridiculous puffy jacket?
I think it was an orange one originally, yeah. Wasn't it?
The classic Barry Burton.
I'm disappointed looking here, seeing Kevin Durand plays Barry Burton, and he's nowhere near as cuddly as the real Barry Burton.
Yeah,
he's the guy from the intro movie for the first Resident Evil game just to come back and play Barry Burton.
Yeah. That would have made it far better.
That's it.
Could have offered, was it a skeleton key to Jill or a lockpick?
I was going to say, it would make
Jill,
the
master
whole,
of unlocking.
Yeah, it would make the whole series of films worthwhile if he showed up in the film and literally said to Jill, you are the master of unlocking.
In common with all the rest of the Resident Evil films, I do not recommend them. This may be a little bit better than other ones, but that isn't saying very much at all. Avoid it if you possibly can.
And you can. Okay, so one of our other great white hopes for the arse end of the summer / start of winter season in the multiplex was Rian Johnson's Looper. Rian Johnson, of course, of Brick and the Brothers Bloom repute. So we were quite excited to see what he was going to do with this time-travelling tale of people what shoot people who are sent back from the future and that. Yes, Drew, you give us a wee rundown on Looper.
So the premise is this. In the not-too-distant future, a class of criminals called Loopers will emerge, whose job is to dispose of unwanted persons marked for elimination by criminal gangs. The twist being that these persons are sent back through time from a future where time travel has been invented and quickly outlawed, but where it is nearly impossible to dispose of a victim's corpse. So these unfortunate unwanteds are rather neatly killed and disposed of in a past where no one will know they even existed, let alone are missing. On occasion, though, a looper will find that their victim is rather familiar to them, as their future self sent back, closing their loop. Turns out that most of these loopers are happy with this, as it represents a bumper payday and a guaranteed lifespan in which to spend their loot. Now, one of these loopers, Joe, fails to kill his future self, and things basically turn to shit after that. His future self escapes and gets all Terminator-y as he attempts to hunt down and kill the individual who will one day become a notorious gangster known as the Rainmaker, who has severely affected the old Joe's life. And after that, it's sort of a chase movie. What might set this apart, though, is the quality of the director and quality of the stars. In this case, it stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt, a favourite around these parts, and Bruce Willis.
Apparently it's got Emily Blunt and a kid in it as well. Do you remember that?
I do, because the kid was our big talking point, Craig. I don't know if Scott felt the same, but...
That's right, you and I had a good conversation about Looper, did we not?
We did. The second half of the film, just... I didn't feel it ruined it for me, but I just thought it was a really bad choice. I mean, The future that these people live in isn't particularly unrecognisable to us. Most of the vehicles are from somewhere between sort of like 1990 and now. Clearly the economy of the United States where this is set has gone downhill and people have had to keep old cars for a long time, like all the American 1950s cars in Cuba. They've had to make do, patch up cars, keep them going for a long time because the economy's not what it was. There's an unsurprising reference to the fact that most of the money's moved to China. And... so, I mean, it keeps it quite familiar, not the trap that some sci-fi falls into of trying to make it really, like, futuristic, which you date it very, very quickly and generally looks stupid anyway. And there are other nice wee touches, just to make it a wee bit different. There's some people have developed a mutation to have telekinesis, but it seems to be dismissed quite quickly as just basically just a trick that, you know, sad men use to pick up women. And to begin with, that just seems like it's just a wee thing just to make it seem a bit different from our world, and that's okay. I don't know how to go on to the next bit without ruining it, though.
Don't go on to the next bit, then.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't think it was okay in the first place. I thought it was stupid. I thought it was... I've heard some interviews with the director, and he's talking about the old adage of how you can, with these kind of films, you're allowed one big ask, in this case time travel, and that's your lot, and you think, so it should be as many as you like.
You should be able to... as many as you want, yeah.
And I think that's bullshit, because the more you sit in, and there's also magic, because that's what telekinesis is, it's magic.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing, it was magic, and I didn't like it, but it was just
this
like,
is a conversation
just this one
we
thing.
Had.
Yeah, it was basically a wee throwaway thing, and it didn't bother me because it seemed such an inconsequential thing.
But to have it become the major plot point as it goes on becomes on shaky grounds at that point.
I'm actually really glad that I haven't spoke, or I don't think Drew or I spoke to you about this yet, Scott. But I thought, oh god, this is going to be one of these ones where I go, it really fucking annoyed me, and the second half of the film ruined it for me. And I thought you were going to be like, okay, for me, film of the year. So I'm actually really glad that you've taken umbrage at the same thing I have.
I will say it's one of the precious few films this year that I've liked or was interested in enough to go and see twice.
Yes.
And unfortunately, because I came out of it quite liking Looper. I thought it's very solid. It gets most things right that I can kind of go with, and it has a few minor flaws, but it didn't bother me that much. When I went back and saw it the second time, everything that was, you know, sometimes when I do this, for things like Dark Knight Rises, or it was actually Dread, the two films that I've seen twice, and all the times I went to those things, I could still appreciate the things that I liked in it, and I learned to just completely overlook or explain away the kind of minor things, they sort of vanished away into the background. With this film, all the little minor niggles just sort of jumped out at the screen again and just kind of ruined it for me again. And I did like it a lot less second time round.
You actually sound quite angry, but you sound like you're actually getting quite militant about this, which I like.
For a lot of the time, I thought this was, you know, this could actually be some of the hopes for a really good film this year.
Yeah.
And it's because it comes so close to delivering, and when there's obviously been an awful lot of thought expended in pretty much every aspect of this film, and it just annoys me when bits of it just don't seem to make any sense. It's obviously been done, as the director says, it's on a tight budget. So if you're going to do that, why have a completely pointless hover bike thing that looks absolutely dreadful? I mean,
it's terrible,
it's like parody of the 1977 Star Wars land speeder effect.
It would have looked better on a dirt bike.
It would. I mean, and there's no reason for it.
It didn't fit in with anything else either, because even like you see the future, the time thing, the time travelling device is really low tech.
Yeah.
It's clearly been made in somebody's garage. And what bothered me, there's so many nice sweet touches too, just that, I mean, just that acting wise, you've got Joseph Gordon-Levitt's clearly really studied Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
And he's really like him, that's great. There's some funny bits in there, it's great. And there's some really nice touches about how you can affect people in time.
Mm-hmm. And there's
Paul Dano's character in particular.
There's some really great lines in there as well. There's some really good snappy lines. It's got a pretty good human heart to it and all that kind of thing. It's just all these little annoying things on the outside just keep encroaching onto it and pulling you out of it. And
what bothered me more than anything with the thing we're talking about, because I was enjoying it so much up to this point, and like saying the things I was enjoying, the acting and the wee touches done, like there are scenes where Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Bruce Willis are the same character, and there are scenes in a diner where I don't think it's accidental. It really feels like it's been shot like you would shoot a split screen effect if you were having the same actor play both people. You know, it really felt like that. So it was like wee touches, like I just did kind of sell them being the same person.
Well, the best example of that, right, is a picture I've just tweeted a link to from IMDb. It's in the IMDb picture gallery because Rian Johnson likes to shoot on 35mm film, thank you, Ryan, his own sort of behind-the-scenes photographs. And there's a fantastically overly grainy picture there I've just tweeted a link to of Gordon Levitt in his Bruce Willis sort of subtle prosthetic makeup facing a cast of Bruce Willis's head.
Cast of Bruce Willis, yeah, I see that.
And it's just a fantastic photograph. And like I said, there's a lot to like about Looper. And
yeah, so they've gone around like budget issues by just using craft and hard work and stuff, and it really sells that. It really feels good. And I said there's interesting things about what?
Sorry, no, I just had a picture of Bruce Willis with one of the guns, which these guns are stupid. Sorry, yes. They're absolutely ridiculous. I mean, all of the guns in the film are stupid.
Yeah, but the Gats are real, though. That's, you know, those the ridiculously large guns are actual guns. That's
they're real,
crazy thing.
What the assault rifle that Bruce Willis has got here?
No, the assault rifle. No, the Gats. No. That's a P90, that's real also.
You don't remember that from GoldenEye? That's a P90, that's real.
I don't like the way that old Joe has this beef with the gang of hitmen is ended in a very unsatisfying way that doesn't seem to gel with any of the rest of the film.
Yeah, it doesn't seem... Because the character's pissed off because of what happens to him, but it doesn't seem to... It just seems unnecessary that he would go quite as far as he did to them.
But it's not even, it's just the fact that he can do it. It is pulled from nowhere to basically wrap up a loose end, and it doesn't make any sort of sense as to why one guy can just...
You know, it wasn't even much of a loose end.
There's no reason to do it, and there's no point of having a little first-person shooter sequence at the end of the film just to make sure you've got rid of all the characters you've introduced. No, not buying it. I didn't like that end at all.
Yeah, so they're bits that are good, and I like the craft that's gone into it. And I'd accept this telekinesis thing as just a wee thing to make it to set the world apart. If you don't like it, fair enough. I mean, it wasn't enough to bother me because it just seemed like a wee throwaway thing. And then suddenly get this magic thing coming, more or less. And what bothers me most about that is it was so utterly unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've already established that this person has ruined Bruce Willis's life. He had more than enough motivation there.
Mm. That's the thing about it is that I was perfectly happy to accept it, because at the first mention of this telekinetic sort of thing, 10% of people have telekinetic abilities, and I went, oh, what, really? And then another character quickly dispels it by saying, yeah, basically nothing ever came of it. Some guys used it to try and
pick up
in bars to impress women by making quarters float. And then nothing else is said about it. And I thought, actually, I like the fact that he set up this potentially massive plot point and then dismissed it totally. He's thrown me a curveball, I like it, because that would have been a silly place to go. And then a wee bit later, another character talks about it and says, yeah, it's great, because you know in the bars, all these guys that used to try and make quarters float, I never told them I had the power as well, and I used to just make the quarters stay in their hand, and it used to get them really frustrated. And I thought, whew, that's another funny little joke, but thank God, I thought we were actually going there. And then we actually go there.
Yeah,
and like you say, Drew, there's absolutely no point to it whatsoever, and it totally ruins the rest of the film from that point on, because like I said to you, I went to see a film where a man and his future self, or a man is trying to kill his future self, right? That alone is like, a man is trying to kill his future self, what? Right, that's got me hooked. That's the film I went to see. I didn't go to go and see Carrie or The Fury,
yeah,
which were both shit in my opinion.
I've not seen either, fortunately. Yeah, but that's what, because there were just other bits too, and it was like, seemed really committing to the film. There's a really notable act which is involved with Bruce Willis, old Joe's attempts to find this gangster, where, I mean, the director really has the courage, his convictions, and many other films and studios probably would have completely pussied out of this act that he does. And it's not a scene, but it doesn't need to be, but you know what has happened.
He's going to appear, and we're going to find out that it actually hadn't happened, and it'll all be all right, and then he appears, and it has happened. Yeah, he did it, and you think, fuck.
And they really committed, and I thought that was fantastic. I thought it was great at Bruce Willis too, because it's the sort of thing that a guy who's as careful about his image as he is, he would have thought possibly wouldn't have done.
Yeah.
But apparently from the start, he was right up for it.
Well, it's like my good lady said, like that was the point at which she went, okay, right, I'll buy into this film, because actually, that's actually sold it to me. I'm committed to these characters now, because I found really that difficult to deal with.
It's really got the courage, his convictions. Yeah. But I mean, I know I'm repeating myself, but
they were committed to making this film, so I will now commit myself to watching it.
And I know I'm going to repeat myself, but just, it's the thing that we're talking about that ruins it. It was just so unnecessary, even if it wasn't stupid, which it is. It was so unnecessary, because you've just established that this guy's ruined his life, he's going to do something about it. What more did you need? It was working fine as it was, and then it just like, oh, magic, ooga booga.
It's not to say there's not a lot to like about Looper. The first hour of it, I was like, totally, yes, this is one of the better things I've seen. That they have the necessary, they've got the Austin Powers scene of where they don't break you don't have Michael York breaking the fourth wall to tell you relax about it, but you've got the scene where the two of them meet each other in the diner, and any questions you have about the whole time travel thing, you know, are sort of swept to one side by Bruce Willis saying, look, we could sit and talk about the logistics of this forever, but we'll just end up making diagrams on the table with straws. And you're like, yeah, okay, I'll buy that. I'm not going to ask too many questions about the time travel stuff, because I was enjoying it up until that point. I found, like, there was a lot to enjoy just watching little moments with Gordon Levitt, who, like you said, Drew, has quite obviously studied Bruce Willis quite intently, and the sort of...
And it's a lot of subtle stuff. It really sells it's the same man.
The first scene where he's sitting... at the table opposite Jeff Daniels' character, Abe, and just watching him there sort of in his sort of false bravado in the face of... He's sitting in front of a guy at a table, and there's a very real prospect that this guy sitting across from him was actually about to kill him now. And to watch him trying to act nonchalantly in the way that Bruce Willis's, you know, one of Bruce Willis's characters would act nonchalantly, the sort of the smirk and the uncertainty underneath it, was actually, I thought, this is actually quite entertaining just in and of itself. I don't want them to rely on it too much, but... Again, that's another thing where I think to myself, okay, he was really invested in this, and so, okay, you've given me something, I'll give you some more of my time. And then just so much stuff in it. There were some design aspects of it which were really cool, and then, like you say, Scott, they throw in, like, really shit hover bikes and things like that, and then they just those last few reels just, like, pull the carpet right out from underneath it, and I couldn't forgive it for that. Up until that point, I was thinking, this is like going to end up being in my top 10 films of the year, and nah, I'm sorry, I just really, really was disappointed by it.
Especially for me, the kind of the middle third where it was basically acting like a Western, I was really I really liked that. I thought a lot of that worked really well. A lot of good character moments in it. As I say, there was, you know, great performances from everyone involved, and the child that we're avoiding talking about does, you know, tremendously well, I think. And in that role. But
he was actually really, really fantastic. It's just not a great role.
And for all these things, I suppose it's to its credit that the more interesting a film is, the more likely I am to sort of start picking it apart in minute detail.
Yes.
And that's why I'm doing it with Looper. But it's just so annoying that I just feel that, for me at least, it's just, you know, a gnat's ball hair away from being something really good, but they just chose like one wrong direction at some point, and it snowballed into making the end kind of unsatisfying. And
it was a bee's dick away from being this year's Inception.
Yeah, I still liked it more than enough to recommend that anyone should go and see it. If you've got even the slightest interest in science fiction as a genre, it has to be seen in that regard. But I was just hoping that it would be the best film of the year, and it's not.
Yeah, so I wouldn't want to put anybody off going to see it, because it's interesting enough to make it worthwhile, but you should go with the knowledge that, you know, it's definitely got rather fatal flaw in it.
It's bizarre that they had the commitment to follow through on these things with the character and the act that we didn't think was going to happen but actually did happen and things like that. It's bizarre that Rian Johnson had the commitment to follow through on that stuff but not actually to have the commitment to follow through on his own plot. feeling the need to introduce magic.
It wasn't like everything else around it was stupid. It was this one thing. Because when, like, I kind of saw the ending coming, but I liked that. I thought that was the right thing to do.
Well, it's like Scott says, that middle third of it where it's playing out like a Western and stuff, it's like, yeah, that stuff, that would be really... It's like, you can sit there and watch it and think, oh my God, that's tremendously stupid. And the annoying thing about it is, this is a great scene. It's just that bit's ruining it and it doesn't even need to be there.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly, that's it. Because, I mean, like, I'm liking all the rest of it. I like the setup, I like the world, I like the tension of the Western bit. You got the showdown coming, you know what's happening, and I like the ending, it made sense. It was just that one bit in the middle, but it's so close to being enough to completely ruin it, and it almost seems that you think it has ruined it, Craig. I'm not quite so gone to that, but I really just thought it was stupid. And it's just, as I said, it was so unnecessary, and it wouldn't so easy to change, because it was just the one thing. Everything around it, all the setup around it, the framework, was fine, but just this one thing in the middle... Which made no sense.
I'll watch it again when it's on demand, just to satisfy my, feelings. But it did really. I might even just get as far as watching the first half of it again. Maybe I can appeal to Ryan Johnson for just like a highlights package, just of Emily Blunt. Because at the end of the day, I'll watch Emily Blunt in a like playing a goldfish in a bowl or something. You know what I mean? But. I just think, do you know, the other reason I would actually like to watch it again is to listen to it in sync with that. Actually, I think it probably only work in the cinema because I guess sort of the running time will probably be slightly on the different on the home formats is the commentary that Ryan Johnson made available on his Tumblr blog for you to listen to on your headphones while you're watching the film in the cinema.
Yeah, going to the cinema with it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So actually that might have been interesting. So I don't know if... I guess being digitally projected and whatnot, I don't know, maybe are running times in the cinema the same as on home formats now? Or
they are if you're in America or get the Blu-ray.
Right.
The only time it would be different would be PAL DVD, assuming there's not a different cut of it.
Yeah, if I'm watching it here on streaming, though, I wonder what that...
I've never understood that. I mean, presumably you're talking about the difference between, like, you know, 25 and 30 frames per second, but it's still per second. I mean, it's not like everyone talks marginally slower in the UK releases, so I don't know if that really holds
quicker.
Yeah, exactly.
You ever heard the difference in the pitch is slightly higher in UK releases because it runs slightly quicker?
That's my excuse for all of my impersonations being shit. I only learned to impersonate people from PAL home video formats, never the NTSC ones. So it'll be worth watching, sort of. I guess if I can stream it legitimately from a US source when it becomes available and listen to that commentary, I suppose will be interesting. But yeah, it's just like you say, Scott. It's just if it were just a film that started out well and then finished like really craply, I wouldn't be so angry about it. It's only because it promised so much and almost delivered, like you say, that it's made me so irate. I'm just frustrated more than anything.
Yeah,
it's not like I don't love Ryan Johnson anymore. We'll always have Brick. But, yeah. And then for Bruce Willis to say this is... Bruce Willis has sort of publicly said this is the best thing I've ever done. No, it's not.
It's so clearly not.
Yeah.
No, could have been.
No, it's not, Bruce. Have you forgotten 12 Monkeys and Hudson Hawk? yeah, what? Well, that's
Last
not a
Boy
joke.
Scout.
That's not a joke.
Last Boy Scout,
that's
yeah.
not a joke. It's not a joke. That's not a joke.
Apparently it's not a joke, Scott.
It's not a joke. But yeah, there you go. Perks of being a wallflower, Scott. Is Hermione alright in this?
The kids are alright. The trailer kind of made The Perks of Being a Wallflower seem like a twee teen coming-of-age film, and the only reason it would come to anyone's attention was because it does have Emma Hermione Granger off Harry Potter Watson as the female lead, and that's probably not too far away from the truth, but certainly by no means a bad film. So the film follows Charlie, played by Logan Lerman, who is just starting high school, a new high school, and he's not overly enthusiastic about it. He's a shy and retiring type by nature, and doesn't make friends easily, and it doesn't help much that he's still in a somewhat fragile mental state, who's best friend killed himself last term, and he's not reacted to this too well. While initially things go as badly as anticipated, with lots of lunches alone in the school cafeteria, he soon winds up in the orbit of a flamboyantly gay senior, the walking stereotype that is Patrick, played by Erza Miller. Patrick's got his own skeletons in his closet, but nonetheless, they kind of become friends, and this leads Charlie to become drawn into Patrick's circle of friends, including his stepsister, played by Emily Watson. And again, she has her own skeletons in her closet, and there's also an assortment of other minor characters, such as the punk rock chick who has her own skeletons in her closet, and the vampire-loving goth chick who has her own skeletons in her... You get what I mean. It all sounds something like an explosion in a cliche factory, and there's, I suppose, a certain twist from having a film where all of the central characters are basically a federation of the weird kid in the group from other teen films. As it's a character piece, there's really not much in the way of plot that I can relate to you, other than it follows the broad outline of Charlie's life and personality as it develops over the course of a year or so, leading up to him becoming separated from his newly found older friends at the end of the year as they head off towards college. And over the course of that year, we'll have to deal with some of those manifold cupboards and their manifold skeleton inhabitants. It's only there that the film stumbles a little bit. By the final reels, it's dropping drama bombs so often that it's surprising that it hasn't been drama bombed back to the drama stone age, and the cumulative effect is a little bit wearing. While it's good that the characters have been realised in such detail, the details do seem to result in one of the most statistically unlikely concentration of troubled teens in film history. This stretch and believability aside, there's not too many bones to pick with The Perks of Being a Wallflower. The characters might for some hit the unbearably quirky limit, but they're inside mine, and the script allows for a number of funny moments, and when tasked with portraying levels of drama that could easily spill over into melodrama, the cast perform pretty well, and it's only the script's pylon of trauma at the end that throws the pacing and performances for a bit of a loop. It's also one of the few recent American films set in a high school that doesn't portray it as some sort of combination of Lord of the Flies, Thunderdrome off Mad Max and a WrestleMania main event. It's not a film that I can completely bury in plaudits. It tries its hardest, but there's an air of familiarity to most of the characters and most of the events that give it a sort of seen-it-all-before kind of air to it, even if not in quite this combination. That said, there's probably going to be plenty of younger kids than I watching this who haven't seen this sort of stuff before, and will probably get a lot more out of it. That's the thing about coming-of-age movies. There's one potential audience member born every minute, if not for this particular one, then for one 15 years down the line or so. Minus 5 stars for having characters not recognising Heroes by David Bowie.
Oh.
I mean, this is set in something like 1980-something, so it's kind of pre, you know, internet everywhere.
But that aggression will not stand.
But, I mean, they apparently have trouble tracking this track down, even in a pre-internet era, when it is, you know, the single most overexposed song of the past few decades.
Mm. That's the single most awesome.
Well, yes, but I mean, yes. If you said, right, there was this song that I heard, it was talking about, you know, you could be a hero just from one day. If you ask anyone in, say, the Western world, I'm sure they would be able to tell you that it's obviously Heroes by David Bowie. But they've spent, like, a whole course of a year apparently trying desperately to track down this track and having no luck.
This very obscure indie track.
Yeah. So, yeah, minus 5 stars.
Only available on a limited vinyl pressing.
It's pretty solid. If you're in the market for some kind of coming-of-age teen film, then this is a pretty good choice. As I say, some pretty good performances and some pretty good scripting. By no means the best film we've ever seen this year, but yeah, it's above average.
Above average, get in. Drew, what's Killing Them Softly all about?
It's 2008, it's the height of the recent financial crash, and boo-hoo, armed robbers and assassins and drug dealers are finding times tough as well. Two low-life losers rob an illegal card game, and fixer thug Jackie Colgan is brought in to clean up the fallout. That's more or less the plot. It doesn't have much of a plot. It doesn't have much of anything, other than lots of reasons to hate it. From the very first scene, this film's on my bad side. It opens with scenes of like car parks and desolate urban wastelands, while a speech by Barack Obama is heard over the top. The speech is then interrupted at seemingly entirely random moments by discordant stabs of noise, which is spectacularly irritating and utterly pointless. There's no pattern to the interruptions. There's no changing of the meaning by occluding portions or anything like selective editing or something. In fact, what it's very much more like is a juvenile being bored of something and making fart noises through it. It's apparently an attempt at satire, and unfortunately it continues throughout the film, but it consistently fails to work. It does seem to be a companion piece to something like The Girlfriend Experience, which was, you know, financial advice for hookers. This film seems to be weathering a financial storm for hitmen and robbers. It's just such a pointless film. And the biggest possible one, actually, is the cast. I mean, Killing Them Softly is attracting the likes of Brad Pitt and James Gandolfini. And the only reason I can think of for actors like him to take roles in this movie is purely ego. Now, it's certainly not script quality or searing dialogue, so it must be the opportunity to deliver monologues with the camera lingering on them for extended periods of time, even though the monologues are crushingly dull. What seems like about 4 hours long scene of Brad Pitt and James Gandolfini sitting in a restaurant so that James Gandolfini can whine on and on about all these women he used to sleep with and how his wife got annoyed and then he went to prison and that made everything boring. And that he should probably get a divorce. I'm already losing the will to love just thinking about it. And the film's full of bits like that. And the weird thing is, the performances aren't bad. The performances, in fact, are the only thing of merit anywhere in the film, but it's to absolutely no end. It's like getting Luciano Pavarotti to sing Justin Bieber songs. I mean, and the obvious thing to say here is that it's considerably less clever than it thinks it is, and I should probably add a few more adjectives in there alongside considerably. Well, then again, I suppose that would be inaccurate, as it's not clever at all. Its attempts at satire and political relevancy are ludicrously crass, hugely heavy-handed, and utterly ineffectual. And the whole film is a bland, self-absorbed waste of time and talent. Basically, it's a Tarantino film without any wit, style, or any of the stuff that makes a Tarantino film a Tarantino film. Even one of the bad ones. Avoid.
There you go.
Yeah, it's rubbish.
Yeah.
I have a little more to add about it. It's a film that seems to trade entirely on the fact that it has attracted a cast that were better in other films, and is trying desperately to convince you that they were actually the characters from those other films, and trying close by on reflected glory from other better filmmakers. And there's a lot of people here that are very good actors but are given nothing to do, and do it at great length, and it's just not in any way at all interesting. I cannot believe that I'm watching the same film as... I mean, this film was generally quite positively reviewed, and I cannot for the life of me work out why. It's like I've gone into a parallel universe. There's nothing interesting in this film, and it's been, you know, lauded for having, you know, it's got a good political message underlying it all, and it's subtle.
It isn't.
It's got a telly in a few occasions, and it's playing something that is essentially irrelevant to the plot. And this is apparently, you know, it's a grand political message. No, it isn't. You're being fooled again. Just stop.
No, it's basically like the filmmakers seem to have an issue with President Obama's the best I can think, but the way they've, like his economic policy or something, they've just decided to blow a rasp and stick fingers up at the screen.
Yeah, where's our bailout for the hitman industry? You do it to those bastards in Detroit, but not the hard-working killers of America. Yeah. Nah, this film can get fucked.
There you go, you heard it here first. This film can get fucked. You don't see that on many posters, do you? I would love for that to make it onto the poster for that now. Or, sorry, the home formats releases. This film can get fucked. 1 star. Which leaves us, Scott, with Ruby Sparks.
Ruby Sparks sees Paul Dano as a struggling writer who had a...
Not that fucker early, again.
You just can't beat Bookham Dano. He's everywhere. His character had a hit novel fairly early on in his life, his career. But since then, he's been afflicted with writer's block and a few other setbacks. He still was struggling to come to terms with his father dying. Also, his long-term girlfriend left him just after his father died. And it's basically turned him into a shell of a man. He can't write, and he's... basically struggling around being kind of pathetic and depressed and all that kind of stuff. At the insistence of his therapist, at some point he's to try and get him back into the writing horse, he's told to write about a woman. Fair enough. This comes to him in a dream as the red-haired Ruby Sparks. He is inspired by this, goes off, writes a character down in a few days, is very happy with himself and seems to have got over this. Seems to be taken as a positive development up until the point when the character that he just wrote appears in real life, at which point shit gets critical. It turns out that he has, you know, manifested this woman out of thin air, and of course, being that as he had written her to be, you know, perfect for him and in love with him, he's, you know, suddenly finds himself in the middle of a relationship with someone who he's just created, which everyone finds a little bit weird. It has a lot of charm in here, particularly some fabulous shots of Paul Dano and some of the other supporting cast, basically doing sort of, oh my god, I'm going mad, kind of double takes for about 15 minutes, which works pretty well. It's kind of like a running gag that remains quite funny for all this. But it turns out that this is a real girl. Everyone else can see her too. And for the most part, this works pretty well. There's some really nice character moments in there. It does fall apart a little bit towards the final reels where, as you might expect from something like this, it does kind of unravel once Paul Dano's character, Calvin, works out that if he finds anything that he's not particularly liking in Ruby's character, he can just go up to a typewriter and change it. It starts off as a very light-hearted knockabout comedy, and towards the end it changes to something a little bit darker, which doesn't really work in the transition. It's a bit too sudden, and I suppose it's inevitable to find a way to end this, but it doesn't quite work for me. That aside, there's enough positives in the rest of the film that it makes it well worth a look. Lots of really nice little character touches. I like Paul Dano as a character actor. I think he works quite well. But while he's not being stretched here, I think he's proven that he can do sort of geeky and awkward quite well enough that this probably wasn't much of a challenge for him to pull off this character.
Well, he did manage it for like three quarters of a film and Let Him a Sunshine without actually speaking a word.
Yeah. But it all works very well. There's a tremendous supporting cast from the likes of Annette Bening, Dorio Banderas, Asif Mandevi from The Daily Show, Elliot Gould, Steve Coogan, and all of which turn out to be a solid supporting cast for the main leads to bounce off. It all works very well. I found it quite enjoyable. It is, I believe, from the director of Little Miss Sunshine, if I'm right in saying that.
It sounds familiar.
It certainly shares a lot of DNA with it, even if it doesn't. It is of that kind of quirky indie comedy ilk, and it works very well. I enjoyed it quite a lot. I'd certainly recommend anyone to go and give it a bash.
Seems interesting.
It is interesting, Craig. It is interesting.
And with that, we round out our comeback podcast.
Don't call it a comeback. Been here for years.
Thank you for listening. As always, don't forget, if you want to get in contact with us, it's podcast@theoneliner.com. You can follow us on Twitter @theoneliner, and you can find us on there individually as well. We don't have anything half as interesting to say as John Carmack, but you never know. Yes, we will be back, hopefully with less of a gap, unless Scott dies again. You're not going to... Oh, no. That's him away.
Back into the freezer, get another one out, Craig.
We're going to have to rinse that Petri dish out and start all over again. Damn these clones, Drew, and their limited lifespan.
I know.
Such is life. Such is death.
Now, people think Moon was science fiction. It was a documentary around the one-liner.
Yes. Scott looks remarkably like Dolly the sheep.
And Gertie the robot simultaneously somehow.
Yes. So, thanks once again. Speak to you soon. Keep it real. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. There's nothing worse than a booby.
Oh, there's nothing worse than a booby.
There is nothing you can name that is anything like a booby.
Dirty old boobies tied up with string. These are a few of my favourite things.